This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. Today, we will conduct a phone interview with Dr. Chip Taylor of KU, founder of Monarch Watch. He will talk about the current plight of the butterfly and how folks can help provide backyard habitat for monarchs. We have in studio with us Mr. Craig Wood, Solid Waste Management Coordinator for the Johnson County Department of Health and Environment. He will discuss the county's Green Business Awards program and some innovative efforts to reduce waste in non-residential settings. But first, I'm Natural Lee with today's news. Last week, a Texas TV station broke the news that new independent scientific analysis refutes the claim by the oil and gas industry that there's never been a confirmed case of fracking polluting drinking water. WFAA, the ABC affiliate in Dallas, reported that two independent scientists using data from Texas regulators confirmed fracking in Parker County, Texas, with dangerous levels of methane in residents' drinking water. According to Earthworks, the Parker County case is not the first example of fracking polluting drinking water. Quote, "It's time for the U.S. EPA to come clean about how fracking pollutes drinking water," said Jennifer Quirrell, Earthworks executive director. "The EPA knew about this water pollution, as it did in Wyoming and Pennsylvania. But at the moment of truth, EPA withdrew in all cases rather than definitively declare that fracking pollutes drinking water," end quote. Sharon Wilson of Earthworks Texas concluded, quote, "It's no wonder that communities across the country, from Texas to California, from Colorado to New York, are trying to ban fracking. We can't trust our government to protect us. We certainly can't trust the oil and gas industry. There is no other alternative." Solar house parties, church celebrations, solar workshops, and more will combine to make June 21st a very big day. It's the longest day of the year, the first day of summer, and the day when 16 organizations will encourage the world to hashtag put solar on it. Sure, social media will help spread the word, but the day figures to be about much more than campaigns on Twitter or Instagram. It will be equal parts fun and business, as some groups will host gatherings while others will unveil new technologies that will help the solar industry continue the dominant year that began with more new electricity generation than any other power source. All across America, there are opportunities to hashtag put solar on it, to turn our homes, our churches, our schools, our lands, and our neighborhood rooftops into solutions to climate change. Some of the groups involved in this National Day of Change are Mosaic, Organizing for Actions, Interfaith Power and Light, World Wildlife Fund, and the Sierra Club, to name a few who will be promoting, planning, and organizing throughout the nation. A host of celebrities, including Sir Paul McCartney, actress Helen Bonham Carter, and singer Tom York, have added their voices to the growing call for a fundamental rethink of the UK government's shale gas strategy. Kicking off a major new campaign, quote, "We need to talk about fracking," more than 150 profile names from the world of music, film, art, and science are calling for a moratorium on shale exploration until a genuinely independent, balanced, and thorough public debate is held into the potential dangers the industry holds for the country. The group is arguing that regulations are being changed to accommodate fracking without sufficient public debate as to the risks associated with the activity. The campaign launches as the government continues to pursue shale gas expansion across the country. The Queen's Speech, the official opening of Parliament, is expected to announce a change in trespassing laws to allow shale gas exploration firms to drill under private land without requiring landowners' permission. Please keep in mind that these articles can be found on our Eco Radio Facebook page. And here we have Elaine in studio for our interview.
Thank you, Erin. And we're going to talk first tonight with Dr. Chip Taylor of KU. He's with the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. And he spends a lot of his time directing a program called Monarch Watch. He is an insect ecologist, and he works on things other than butterflies. But we're going to be talking tonight particularly about the monarch and what is going on this year. Are you there, Dr. Taylor?
Yes, I'm here, Elaine. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, Dr. Taylor actually did present a program to our Sierra Club locally sometime last year. I don't remember when, Dr. Taylor, but I thought, you know, we've heard reports this year that the monarch populations are lower than they've ever been since they first started recording the number of monarchs back in, what, 1993? Is that the case?
Yes, that's the case. The overwintering population in Mexico, and that's where we have some gauge as to how big the population is from year to year, because these butterflies that originate in the northern part of the United States and Canada migrate down to Mexico, where they overwinter in large clusters, and they measure the area of the trees occupied by these clusters, and that gives us a sense of how well the population is doing. And last winter, the population was lower, that is, smaller in area than has ever been seen before. And this has raised quite a few red flags and quite a lot of concern, and we're, of course, trying to do something about it.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, for listeners who are not familiar with the butterfly, why do we care? What is it about the monarch that makes it different from other butterflies, and what's it doing in Mexico?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of good answers to that question, I mean, as to why we should care. First of all, this is one of the most spectacular migrations on the entire planet. So it's a biological phenomena. Human beings should not go out of their way, or even inadvertently, to extinguish magnificent biological phenomena of one sort or another. And to get a sense of what this phenomena is all about, you either have to go to Mexico or you have to see one of the magnificent films that's available that shows what it's like to be within one of these forests with 25 million butterflies per acre. I mean, it's beyond easy description, believe me. And even if you were looking at the best film that's ever made, it's never going to be as good as actually being there. So it's truly a wonder that you go down there to Mexico and you're standing amidst the 25 million butterflies that came from all over eastern North America to get there. And, of course, there's been a lot of attrition along the way. And it's just a marvel of survival that they get there. And then, of course, they overwinter. They go through about five months of winter in Mexico, where they simply hang up in trees in large clusters. Then they start to break up and start to move around toward the middle of February. And toward the end of February or early March, depending upon how cold it is, they begin to move north and they restart this recolonization of North America all over again. They go through 3 to 5 generations every summer from March until late October, and then the migration has once again arrived back in Mexico, where they overwinter again. So the phenomenon is pretty remarkable that we have this kind of two-way migration of the butterflies with this incredibly dense population at the overwintering sites. But that's not the only reason. I mean, it's a magnificent phenomenon, and we should preserve it. But, you know, the fact that monarchs are going down says that there's another problem that we have to cope with, and that is that monarchs are simply representative of species that share the same habitats with them. So what are we losing if we lose monarchs? It means that we're losing habitats that support a large number of pollinators, that support a large number of ground nesting birds and other animals. So if we're losing monarchs, we're losing all of those things. And what concerns me is that to lose pollinators means that we're losing the very cohesive parts of the system that keep everything together, because the pollinators pollinate about 70% of the vegetation out there. And, of course, they provide a lot of food for us. So to ignore the existence and the necessity of maintaining the pollinators means that we're shooting ourselves in the foot, so to speak. We have to maintain the integrity of this system that supports us. We can't just ignore the fact that pollinators are necessary without suffering some consequences.
Back to the point that we're seeing such low populations, if I understand correctly from some of my reading, that at the maximum population that we've at least measured since 1993, the expanse of the overwintering trees, and they only hang in particular trees in particular areas, and they return to those areas, it was up to like 44 acres available. But today, you know, this last year when they measured the acreage, it was down to less than 2 acres. shelters that are they are still utilizing for their overwintering.
Yeah, that's correct.
So we have lost, you know, many acres of habitat. Now, is that just because some of the trees have been lost to logging? We used to blame everything on Mexico and say, hey, they're taking out all the trees. Is that the underlying problem now?
No, that's not the underlying problem. It turns out that, you know, while we have been discussing the problem with Mexico and been pointing our fingers at Mexico for a long time, at least some of my colleagues have, that it's not Mexico at all. It's really us. I mean, we're the problem, and we're the problem because agriculture has really intensified in the upper Midwest in the major breeding ground for this butterfly, and it's just amazing. We don't see it here in eastern Kansas and western Missouri as much as you would see it in Iowa and Minnesota and Illinois and the heart of the corn and soybean areas. I mean, there's hardly any habitat left in a lot of those regions. And I'm not exaggerating. I mean, you can drive for miles and miles and miles and notice that there's virtually nothing but grasses in the roadside margins, and the roadside margins are very minimal now compared to what they were, you know, 10 and 20 years ago. So there's almost no habitat left for wildlife in huge areas of the upper Midwest. And this is what's caused the decline of, you know, the birds and the monarchs and the pollinators and so on. So the intensification of agriculture, which is partly due to the ethanol mandate, which was signed into law by President Bush at the end of 2007, the ethanol mandate resulted in the conversion of about 24 million acres of habitat into cropland in just a matter of 5 years. That's an amazing conversion rate. It's an area the size of Indiana. So that's a real part of the intensification problem. The other part of the intensification problem is the fact that we are controlling weeds very differently now from how we did it before. While we used various herbicides in our row crops before, none of them were particularly effective in getting rid of milkweed. Milkweed still lingered in those fields. And then when we adopted the Roundup corn and soybeans, milkweed was doomed. Milkweed just kind of disappeared from all the row crops.
Well, slow down. What's the deal with milkweed? I mean, it's just one more weed, right? Why would that make a difference on the monarch population?
Well, it makes a difference because milkweeds are the only host plants for the monarch butterflies. They're the only plants on which they can raise their caterpillars. So we have a very intimate relationship between these butterflies and that group of plants. And with no milkweeds, no monarchs is what it comes down to. And so when you eliminate the milkweeds, either in the roadside margins or in the corn and soybean fields or elsewhere due to some sort of management practice, you're really cutting back on the availability of the habitat for monarch butterflies and therefore the habitats for everything else.
I noticed that there was an article that just came out recently in the Journal of Animal Ecology from a parrot at University of Guelph in Ontario. Now, the monarchs go all the way to Canada, so it's no surprise they're doing work up there as well. They were estimating that 20% of milkweed now had been lost across North America, and that amounted to 1.5 billion plants. And again, they were suggesting through their analysis that this genetically modified corn and soybeans was indeed the problem. Is this new information, or did it just support your ideas?
Well, this is not new information. It supports the ideas that several of my colleagues have been forwarding for quite a number of years. I mean, there was a very detailed analysis of the loss of milkweeds in Iowa by Pleasance and Oberhauser just a couple of years ago, and that certainly made the case for the intensification of agriculture and particularly the use of glyphosate or Roundup to control weeds in those fields. I mean, this goes back to a study that was done in the year 2000, which showed that the basic production of monarchs evolved around corn and soybeans. The more monarchs were produced in corn and soybean fields than in any other acreage out there, and that surprised the daylights out of us. We had no idea that monarchs were doing well in corn and soybean fields, but it was after that that the glyphosate-tolerant plants came on, and the milkweed was just eliminated, and Therefore, we lost at least 100 million acres of habitat in corn and soybean fields alone. So this has been analyzed several ways. That study simply amplifies and adds a different metric to the thing that we've known for 5 or 6 years now, that things are really changing out there, and it's not favorable for monarch butterflies or pollinators.
You know, the awareness in Canada seems to be growing. There was also, I think it was in a blog piece on one of your sites, that they have removed milkweed from the noxious weed list. What is the implication of that?
Well, it's about time. You know, they, on one hand, they promote monarch conservation, and on the other hand, they promote the elimination of milkweeds. I mean, this is not uncommon. You know, government, different branches of governments don't know, have different priorities. And so this has been a conflict that's been going on in Canada for a long time. But finally, they got they became a little bit more aware of the connection between milkweeds and monarchs, and decided that milkweeds weren't so bad after all. We needed to maintain them, and so they took them off the noxious weed list.
That was just last May, I think. It hasn't been very long. And coming from Texas ranch country myself, I mean, the ranchers down there don't appreciate milkweeds either. And Texas is that, for those who don't know the migratory path, Texas is where they lay that initial generation of eggs on their return from Mexico. And having enough milkweed in Texas is kind of a kickstart of this whole process again. So we see in Texas it has been a problem. You know, one of the things we haven't talked about, we've talked about the Roundup-resistant crops and so on. Urban sprawl certainly has removed some of the ag land and the illegal logging that does take place in Mexico. But climate change, I mean, is you hinted at that at our meeting with Sierra Club, that there are things coming down the pike maybe that we need to start dealing with.
Well, yes, and I teach a course called The World of 2040, where I try to make the students look ahead to see what's going to happen, and I wish a lot more people would do this, because if you look ahead and look at the incremental changes that are occurring on the planet, it really is a very sobering sort of look, and we have to deal with a lot of the changes that are coming forth, and there is no question but that the climate is going to continue to change. I sat down with a colleague about 15 months ago, and we were just having lunch, and we were tossing around the idea of, you know, CO2 levels, and we both predicted that CO2 would reach 400 parts per million as an average for a month in April of 2014, this year, and we predicted that 15 months ago. And, you know, it's not rocket science to do this. I mean, you can predict what CO2 levels are going to be in the future by just looking at the incremental increase in CO2. And we've known since the 1830s that CO2 is a heat-trapping gas and that it is going to change the climate on the planet. We know that human beings are responsible for that CO2. It's not a natural process. So we know the temperatures are going to increase. We know that rainfall patterns are going to change. We know that it's going to be more difficult to raise crops in the way we do at the present time. We know we're going to potentially add 2 billion more people to the planet in a very short time, and that there are going to be food shortages and resource shortages and so on to deal with. And yet, you know, there aren't enough futurologists out there. There aren't enough people trying to look at this in a way that they'll help us deal with all of these things. The last assignment I gave my students this semester, I said, you know, I want your top 10 list. I want the top 10 threats that face mankind. I want the top 10 adaptations you think we need to make in order to adjust to this coming climate change. And I want the top 10 things that we should mitigate right now. And, you know, putting all these lists together was really instructive. I mean, it forces you to think about the future, and it forces you to think about the kinds of things that we're going to have to deal with as we move forward. And it's not a pretty sight, especially if we don't confront all of those things. If we let it happen, it will happen, and there will be consequences that we will be scrambling to adjust to.
Well, I wonder, as we've already seen some major droughts in Texas and Oklahoma, in western Kansas particularly, And the way the monarch migrates northward, that second generation moves north as milkweed is emerging, and does the drought then impact the availability of the host plant for the monarch?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Actually, what I'm more worried about is not the droughts with regard to monarchs, but the temperatures. There's a really interesting relationship between how successful the monarchs are and the temperatures in Texas. If the temperatures are really high in Texas in March and April, it has a negative effect on the monarch population. And the reason is that the monarchs keep moving, and they move out of Texas. They don't lay most of their eggs in Texas. They start moving out of Texas. The result of that is that they move north too fast, and they move into areas where it is often too cold, and they lose a lot of their reproduction because things will shut down. We saw that happen in Kansas here a couple of years ago. I think it was 2010. We had a big flush of monarchs that came out of Texas really early, earlier than we'd ever seen them. And then the temperatures shut down, and most of that reproduction was lost. In other words, they laid thousands and thousands and thousands of eggs in Kansas, and virtually all of them were lost because they'd moved too far north too soon. So being really hot in Texas is not a good thing early in the spring. And what's predicted for Texas is that by 2040, just maybe 2050, it will be 6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in Texas in March than it is at present. Wow. I mean, that's going to knock the daylights out of monarch butterflies.
As a former Texan who used to grow monarchs in Texas, that's alarming to hear. And the listeners need to understand, too, that this is the generation that overwintered in Mexico, and they're pretty much on their last legs. They've got the last bit of their energy they're expending to do this before they die. And as you said, they can't go back and lay eggs again. If that generation is lost, then the whole migration basically is not going to happen. You know, I haven't seen many monarchs in my yard this year. I have more common milkweed coming up in the flower beds than I've ever had before, and I've seen not a single larva. Are you hearing reports from other folks in the area who are following this?
Yeah, we are, and actually it's looking a little better than certainly last year, and it's actually better than a couple of springs, certainly better than the last 2 years. In 2012, it was so hot that we had virtually no summer generation here at all. Last year, things were very, very poor, but this year it's looking better. There will be some recovery this year. It won't be a great recovery, but there's going to be some rebound of the population. Unfortunately, the things that we use to kind of assess what's going on doesn't tell us that it's going to be, 50% bigger or 100% bigger, but it's definitely going to be larger than the last overwintering population. But it's certainly not going to be a big, robust population, and we're never going to get back to what we saw in the past because we simply don't have enough habitat out there. We've had pretty good luck around here. We've seen a fair number of monarchs, and we've collected quite a few eggs, more than we usually do for this time of year.
I'm glad to hear that. Now the listeners, I promised them that they would see what they could do to help out, and this is what your Monarch Watch and Monarch Way Station programs are about. We can wind this up. Tell us how the listeners can help.
Well, if the listeners go to our website, which is monarchwatch.org, and they go to the milkweed market, they can see that we have milkweeds available, and we do have milkweeds available for the central part of the United States and still quite a bit for the eastern part of the U.S. And we have milkweeds that come as small plugs, and we sell them in lots of 32, a flat of 32 for $60.80 with shipping is already covered. And all they have to do is place an order through the milkweed market, and we'll send them the milkweeds. We're getting a little late in the season, but we've still got thousands of milkweed plugs available, and we'd be glad to get them out there to people who want to create habitats for monarch butterflies.
And a monarch way station, then, is something in your backyard, or your front yard for that matter, where you've planted milkweeds for the caterpillars, but you also would want to include some nectar plants for the adult butterflies?
Yes, that's correct, and there are quite a few suggestions on various gardening sources as well as ours about the kind of nectar plants to put out there.
And this is critical. I mean, given the loss of milkweeds in the agricultural fields, that we start doing more and more growing of milkweeds in urban settings, maybe. And I've been doing this for years, and I will tell you, there's some beautiful milkweeds out there that are lovely in the yard, and what we call a common milkweed, if you don't mind it spreading a bit, smells good. It's a fragrant, beautiful plant.
Oh, it is. I was just out photographing some in our garden. We have some absolutely fantastic common milkweed out in the garden, and I don't mind that it spreads a little bit. It comes up here and there, and I always kind of marvel at its ingenuity and in terms of how it's able to clone a little bit. But we have some plants that have been well fertilized, and they're taller than I am, and the blossoms on them are just, I mean, they're as big as softballs, and I'm not kidding. I mean, normally a milkweed blossom would be maybe a little bit smaller than a tennis ball, but these are as big as softballs, and I'm going, wow, I got to take pictures of those. It's a plant that will respond to good care and lots of fertilizer.
And survive from year to year. It'll stick around.
It survives from year to year, and it smells wonderful. It's probably the best-smelling thing out there in the garden.
And I understand it's one of those species that the butterfly will lay on very readily as well. It's a desirable.
Yes, it's the main host for this butterfly. It's the main species that supports this population.
So I would encourage listeners, if you have a church garden, if you have a school garden, if you don't have your own backyard already planted, please consider, you know, going to this website, themonarchwatch.org. There's also an opportunity there, and I've done this, to learn how to tag monarch butterflies with little paper tags so that we can get more information about their migration. And I think that's really how this program started, wasn't it?
Yes, it is. We started a tagging program years and years ago, and we evolved into an education organization for a while, and with doing some research, and now virtually all of our activities are directed to trying to save this migration.
And I think it's a shift in a new direction, but we appreciate the information that you've given us. And that website, again, is monarchwatch.org. And we've been talking with Dr. Chip Taylor about the plight of the monarch. And I'm glad to hear encouraging news that we expect some rebound in the population this year. And I would certainly encourage all of our listeners to go to the site. You don't even have to get the milkweeds from Monarch Watch. That helps support their program, I know. But there are milkweeds available in the nursery, swamp milkweed, the common milkweed, and the butterfly weed, the very pretty orange one. So you can pick some of these up in your neighborhood if you need to find them there. Any last words, Dr. Taylor?
No, we just encourage everybody to try to get some things out there in their gardens that will support monarch butterflies and pollinators in general. You know, I don't really want to knock what's going on out there for the gardens, but, you know, a lot of the plants that we find at the big box stores are really very nice and showy, and they bloom a lot and so on and so forth. But if you look closely at most of those plants, they don't provide any nectar or pollen for anything. I mean, they've been designed for show. And if we want to provide for pollinators, we have to select plants that pollinators actually use. And those plants contain pollen and nectar, pollen for the bees and nectar for the butterflies and the bees.
And I think there are plant lists also on the website, and there are organizations who can certainly help choose native plants that are better for our native critters. I appreciate very much your talking to us tonight. I know your time is very valuable, and I wish you luck in this project. If we can have you on again sometime next year, we'll see how the monarchs are doing.
Okay, Elaine, very nice to talk to you.
Thank you very much. You know, there's also a story that goes with this whole thing. It's very, very short. The monarchs arrive in Mexico around November 2nd, which is in Mexico the Day of the Dead, El Día de los Muertos. And the local Indian population observed this over hundreds of years and came up with their own local myth that these monarchs that suddenly appeared out of nowhere, fluttering down into the towns there in Mexico, were actually returning souls of their ancestors that came to visit, you know, the descendants. And then they stayed there all winter long, and as luck would have it, these monarchs leave Mexico, headed back for Texas at Easter. And so when the resurrection and the Christian religion was introduced, there was a melding of the native myth and the Christian ideas, and then the ancestor souls were going up to heaven at Easter. So it's interesting how natural phenomena get to be part of the culture as well. But it actually, there's a lot of ecotourism down in Mexico now based on the monarch. And if they should lose that population, it isn't just, you know, the pollination. There's a whole community down there whose history is based on this organism. You want to break for some announcements, Mike? And we'll come back with our next guest after that.
Wednesday was an historic day.
It was?
Hey, this is your old pal, Mike Murphy. You know, I was born on Wednesday, and I'm here to tell you that this Wednesday's child is full of whoa. So join me each and every Wednesday morning until 8 a.m. for music from around the world and around the block. Your Wednesday morning buzz, going 10 years strong.
The wonder of it all, baby.
On Wednesday, all the malls across America connected.
Come join us Saturday, June 21st at 8 p.m. at Knucklehead Saloon for a Cosmic American Music Fest featuring the Heebie-Jeebies, the Silver Maggies, Potter's Field, along with Chad Rex, Cody Wyoming, Tommy Donahoe, Casey Roush, Alan Murphy, and Cameron Hawk. We'll play the music of Graham Parsons, The Birds, and Gene Clark. And the best part is, this is a benefit for KKFI.
Welcome back to KKFI's Eco Radio. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, and I'm Elaine Giesel. I'm your occasional programmer and host for tonight. We've just been listening to Dr. Chip Taylor talk to us about what's going on in the world of the monarch, and we're going to turn things around here, change gears, and I'm going to be talking with Craig Wood. Craig Wood is with the Johnson County Department of Health and the Environment. He's Solid Waste Management Coordinator. And how long have you worked for them, Craig?
I've worked for Johnson County about 5 years now.
And there's a lot of trash in Johnson County, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. We have the largest landfill in the region and supposedly the biggest between Chicago and Denver.
So. And that is a lot of trash.
Yes.
And a good or strong economy and people buying a lot of stuff.
Yes,
you
we
get
have
a lot
lots
of trash.
People with pretty lots of disposable income and lots of trash.
Now, this is for listeners, Johnson County, Kansas, and in Kansas, the state of Kansas requires by law, as do other states, it's not unique to Kansas, I know it was in Texas as well, there are laws that require entities within the state to make plans for how they're going to deal with trash over the long term. Now, that happens in Kansas, right?
Exactly. In the state of Kansas, that entity is every single county. And some of the counties actually band together in the less populous areas and kind of have consortiums. In Johnson County, we do our own plan. That plan that we do is actually required to be updated every year, but every 5 years we do kind of a comprehensive look at the solid waste plan. And if we need to kind of shift gears or whatever, that's kind of when we do that, is about every 5 years. The newest version is kind of being looked at right now. So we actually, as Johnson Countyans, as Johnson County government, we actually look at a 20-year horizon. The law says 10 years, but with our population and the growth that Johnson County has seen, we look at a 20-year horizon. So that means in this latest plan, we look at 20 years into the future, and we're responsible for infrastructure and planning for all the trash that's generated within Johnson County.
And there was a large revision in the plan made about 5 years ago that was adopted by the Board of County Commissioners, and we've been operating under that for the last couple of years. And there's been some controversy. I mean, there anything new, anytime you change how people put things on the curb, because there's a tendency to put it out in the trash can and it goes away. You don't even think about it after that. Always when I work with kids, I'll say, what do you think happens to the stuff that goes down the curb? And they all think it goes nowadays with kids to the recycling.
Yeah.
They don't even get that difference. So there were some major changes in this last major revision of the plan, which is over 5 years now, right,
right.
that it was adopted.
Right.
And those, just, you know, for listeners to be reminded, what did we change back then?
That plan was actually the 2007 plan. We worked on it a long time to implement those changes. But those changes finally came to fruition in 2012, January 1st of 2012. Those changes included, with your trash, you had kind of a limited amount of trash that you could put. We did a volume. There are some communities across the nation that do weight or per bag, those kinds of things. We went with a volume and more of a cart system. Most of our large haulers have automated systems now where they come up and pick up the cart. And it really works nice. There's less, there's really less littering on trash day. You don't have animals or anything like that being able to get into the carts. It's a very clean system. But we didn't require that across the board. But most of our larger haulers do that. With that, with the trash that you got, you also got what we call bundling in the industry, where you get, if you have trash, then you also get recycling. That recycling is kind of, if you will, unlimited. So you can have, you can overfill your recycle bin, but not your trash can. You would have to pay an extra dollar or $1.50, depending on what city you're with or what hauler you're with. To be able to dispose of more trash than the cart that you have or the number of bags. What we also did is we separated out the yard waste from the regular trash. And when you think about it, it's really not that much of a change. When you do yard work, you don't go and put it in your kitchen trash, or you don't mix your kitchen trash and the rest of your household trash. Go out and put it in the leaves, you just put it in a plastic bag. And really what we did is say, hey, we can't put that in the trash can. What we want to do is we want to limit the amount of trash going to the landfill. So we want to separate that out so that we can process that differently than we do with the trash. Because what kind of to go back a little bit, in 2006 and 2007, Johnson County did a solid waste sort, what they call. What we did is we hired a company. We went through this large landfill that we have, about 800 trash trucks a day for a week. And we took out basically an allotment, a Rubbermaid container, if you will, out of every single truck out of that trash, out of the landfill every day. We sorted them by categories. And we measured them by volume and by weight. The leaves and grass were about 11% of the weight that was going into the landfill. Now, that's quite a bit when you really think about leaves and grass are pretty light and fluffy type material. So that was an easy 10% when we're trying to reduce how much going into the landfill. That was a really pretty easy fix, and it was really pretty easy to get out away from the other trash so that we could process it through composting.
And keeping yard waste out of the landfill is not a new concept. I mean, for our listeners on the Missouri side of state line, 20 years. And, in fact, there are centralized compost operations. We're going to talk about that in a minute, too, like Missouri Organic,
yes,
that have been handling this waste. And I know, coming from Texas, that we also, you know, have banned yard waste a long time ago in many municipalities. So sometimes it's a local level, sometimes it can be at the county level. So things have been moving along a couple of years. Would you say the results have been positive in terms of reducing the amount of waste actually going to landfill now?
I think so. We are in the process of actually procuring a similar study again, so that in the next year we can actually measure those results and see what's going into the landfill and what are the proportions of that pie. I did want to mention too that across the nation it's a very common practice with that to separate yard waste away from the trash fraction. And actually, when you say has it been successful, I'd really point to the landfill. Actually, it has a permit with the state, it has a permit with the county to operate, but it also has a special use permit through the city of Shawnee. They actually had a sunset on that special use permit that it was supposed to sunset in 2027. that was a big wake-up call from the county standpoint, because we'd never had an endpoint, a sunset date, on the life of that landfill. Well, when that happened, that's one of the driver
yeah.
for that change in that 2007 plan. With that, we went more. That's what really made us go more aggressive towards waste reduction for the county. When we got all done with the plan and showed some of the results of, hey, here's what we want to do, and implementing all those programs, the landfill itself actually approached the city of Shawnee and said, you know, with all this waste reduction that we're going to have, you know, we've really going to have extra room when the sunset of the when this permit expires in 2027. How about we've recalculated our airspace, and I think we can get it till 2043. So they actually approved an extension of that special use permit to 2043, really in large part based on the waste reduction through our solid waste management plan.
And this waste reduction plan was targeting residential communities, right? This was not really going after the commercial sector, not aggressively.
No, and that was a really interesting result, actually, also of our study, was that we really started to figure out how much of a portion of the trash going into the landfill was commercial and how much of it was residential. The residential sector is a lot more easily tackled, I guess I'll say, whereas we have willing partners in cities and communities, and the hauling situation is much less complicated than commercial, where everybody has a truck, they can haul things to the dump, landfill, where every landscaper can haul material. That's a lot more complicated. We have a limited staff and limited time to be able to do that. So we tackled the public sector first. And I think really when we look back on that 2 years later, I think it's been an enormous success. People have really gotten used to it for the most part. There's a few detractors, but for the most part, I think that everybody's been very positive and really seen a lot of positive change out of the residential side.
So the latest revisions, as I understand it, actually are going after voluntary processes in the commercial sector, the non-residential. Let's call it non-residential because it isn't just businesses. What are we including here?
We're including in this, and you're exactly right, Elaine, that this is more of a voluntary. We aren't prepared to really take a regulatory view of this yet. With this, we are going after everything from multifamily, and it's more of a look at best practices. How do we educate the property owners, the business owners, the businesses themselves on how to reduce their waste to optimize their operations, save money in a large part? But when you look at the multi-tenant areas where you have multiple offices or you have strip malls, those get a lot more complicated because you have different entities involved and they all have different goals. Whereas, like, standalone businesses are one of the easier sides of things. But then multi-unit housing is also – we do have one city, the city of Lenexa in Kansas, where they have they're going to be implementing a new requirement for multi-unit housing, apartments and condominiums, anything over 4 units, to have mandatory recycling in Lenexa.
Well, it starts up and coming now – I understand for the last 5 years, too, you've had something called the Johnson County Green Business Awards. And this doesn't give them money or anything, but it certainly gives them some recognition for their efforts. And I guess I attended the last giving of awards. Can you name names? I mean, generically, maybe, what kind of businesses are getting these kind of awards?
Sure. We've had a lot of interest in schools. We've had lots of interest from all kinds of different private sector. Sprint has gotten lots of national awards for their green practices. They also applied for ours, and we want to give them that recognition because they've worked really hard on that. To be honest, they've got a lot of resources that we don't have access to, so it's kind of a nice laboratory for them to show us what are the best practices, what have they found works, and we don't have to go through all that huge learning curve from that standpoint. We've also had a number of small businesses, the Kansas City Culinary Center in downtown Overland Park. They've done a great job. One of the things they do is to minimize waste. They look in their refrigerators and their freezers, and they say, what do we need to fix? So you can reduce the amount of food waste that you have by saying, hey, look at that. And my mother was a master at it. We had all kinds of leftover nights and all kinds of interesting recipes coming out of our refrigerator when I was growing up.
Well, that brings up the question. I think we've also had a medical center that has gotten this award, insurance mm-hmm. company. Mm-hmm. Now, some of these would have a fairly simplistic waste stream. Maybe they've got some, you know, waste coming out of a kitchen area, cafeteria. But in a medical center, I mean, you've got an enormous, you know, variety of waste mm-hmm. streams. Mm-hmm. So these guys are really working hard to address all these different things. In a restaurant, it's pretty much mm-hmm. food waste. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. unless you've got disposables you're using at the table.
Yeah. Those are great examples.
It's hard for even for Johnson County to – your first step is to walk in and say, what is your waste stream? Let's analyze mm-hmm. what your problem is, and then we can start dealing. But there are things other than even waste. I understand Water One was using mm-hmm. a green driving measure.
That program's really cool. And with these businesses, it's interesting. A lot of things have changed. 5 years ago when I started meeting with businesses and saying, hey, what do you think about a waste reduction program? They're like, I have no idea. We don't deal with it. I don't deal with it. I don't pay the bills. I don't even know how much trash we generate. So I would work with them so that we could figure out how much trash is going out there. And what's kind of interesting is when you have a business and you throw all those things in the dumpster, you might not even be the people that are throwing that stuff in the dumpster. But until you figure out what's there, it's pretty interesting. When you throw in, like if you don't break down cardboard boxes, what you're throwing into the dumpster and you tamp it down is really, for the large part, what you're paying to get rid of is air. Because it's bulky material, and you're really not getting as much in there as possible. One of the other, you were talking about the medical center. They do have some very unique, being a medical facility, they have some very unique waste streams. But you would think that, like, surgical materials, well, there was a surgery nurse at Shawnee Mission Medical Center that was like, we've got to stop this. It's a woven polypropylene material. So it never got any kind of medical waste on it whatsoever. It was clean material. It was to keep the instrument sanitized, but they took it off and they threw it away. And she said, man, this is crazy. So she found a company that would actually partner with them and take it and use it for recyclable because it was clean. Yeah, absolutely sterile and very clean. Some of the other things is, like in the schools, we actually reduced the amount of waste that they were doing by 90% by weight in a number of schools simply by implementing a composting program for their cafeterias. Now, I say simply. It wasn't that simple. There was a lot to it. But you take one element of that, and almost every business, one of the things that still amazes me is how much cardboard is still thrown away. I was out at the landfill today, as a matter of fact, and there was a 30-yard roll-off box almost completely full of cardboard that went to the landfill. By that time, it's probably a little late to recover it, but those are some of those things where if somebody would tell me where that emanated from, I go talk to them and say, hey, do you realize you can actually maybe make some money off of that?
In fact, this corrugated cardboard is one of the more commonly recycled materials along with office paper because they have value.
Yes.
Now, even other materials, though, can help the bottom line by composting or moving other materials. And have you found pretty much across the board if they're implementing waste reduction, it's not costing them money, that they're actually saving money?
In some instances, it is costing, but some businesses don't mind that. But in general, the idea is if you divert material out of your trash can, one instance I know through composting is, say you have a grocery store. Well, you're putting that material into a 40-yard compactor. Well, a lot of the grocery stores, because they want to be good neighbors, they're getting that hauled away daily. But they're not filling that 40-yard roll-off box. But they're paying a certain amount to get it hauled off every single day. Well, when they're diverting that off to composting, they don't have the smelling issue because they don't have the putrescent material. Well, with that, they can keep that 40-yard roll-off box until it's full, and they only have to haul it off once or twice a week.
Right, and when you pull one of these is when it costs you.
Exactly.
Someone has to come pick
it
up.
Pay for the pull, and then you pay for the tonnage in.
Right. You know, we had a program here, it's been a year ago now, on the emerald ash borer, and already had raised concerns at that time that there's going to be a lot of yard waste, if you will, wood waste coming out of this. And I know you have a bit of a story to tell about a new startup, and mm-hmm. there's actually something in the paper about it recently, associated with Missouri Organics, and they're thinking ahead about this emerald ash borer.
Yeah, the folks at Missouri Organic are partnering with a company called the Urban Lumber Company. And they're actually taking a lot of this wood waste, this urban lumber, that no other lumber company wants to deal with, mainly because of things like nails and other cases, fences. If you've ever seen a corner tree basically grow into the fence and it just envelops the fence. Well, those are common things. Nobody's going to want it because of that metal in there. Well, this urban lumber company, Tim O'Neill, is really, I visited their new facility off of 40 Highway and Manchester Trafficway. It is really impressive. They are taking a lot of this. When he got started, he actually just started figuring out, you know what, I can go cut down people's trees and I can use it for my own purposes. And doing woodworking. He's a avid woodworker. Well, when this emerald ash borer thing came along and some of the magnitude started seeing, boy, we really hated to, and I really wasn't involved, but a lot of people are saying, man, we really hate to just chip up all this stuff and get rid of it as mulch. We're going to be buried in mulch if we do that. Well, Tim had a different vision, and so did Kevin Anderson and his brother, where they partnered with Tim, and they are now actually milling lumber from urban trees. And it's really, really impressive. They have some neat, where I think they really separate themselves is in the woodworking community and different projects and from an architectural standpoint, because these trees aren't your normal lumber that you're going to get at the big box stores. It has unique qualities to it. There was a really neat slab at their place, and you can look them up on the website, urbanlumbercompany.com, and you can actually see what some of their inventory is, where they've got everything from hackberry to walnut to specific things that you would not see in any kind of lumber store or lumber yard, really, and they can cut it to your specifications. He even said, look, if you've got your own stump or your own trunk of a tree, we'll mill it for you for $75 an hour.
And as I understand, all the waste that is generated when they cut the ends of the planks and twigs, and that actually Missouri Organics is picking
exactly.
up and using in their compost.
They get to clean it up, and that's a good carbon source for them.
I wonder, too, as a biologist, what we're going to do with all these trees as they're cut down. It sounds like at least we're getting a handle on it. And this is a very unique and artistic, creative way to use this material. You know, if someone is with a company that would be interested in talking to you about getting involved either with a Green Business Award, now that's a self-nominating process,
mm-hmm.
they would go to the Johnson County website and
yes.
or talk to you maybe by
yeah,
phone. Can you give them a website?
Yeah, the website is jocogov.org, so jocogov.org. They can also contact me directly. My name, again, is Craig Wood, and they can call me at 913-715-6917. Or they can contact me via email, and it's craig.wood@jocogov.org.
And the process of getting, nominating yourself for one of these Green Business Awards, I mean, you're going to list the things you're doing already.
Yes.
And document maybe some of the tonnage you've reduced
sure.
or whatever you've implemented. And there's a form they can find on the website. And mm-hmm. as I recall, it's under Green Business.
If you look under Business Waste, it's there. Also, if you're stuck on something, I'd be happy to come talk to you. We actually had a company that I worked with down in New Century where they weren't recycling anything and had me in. And matching with some possible contractors, we think we can reduce their waste by half. In the first part of implementing some recycling programs at their facility.
And, even if you don't have, the everyday office environment, we've had some local businesses that had some very unique waste streams that they, with a little bit of work, had been able to get rid of these products, you know, to zero waste. Some are going towards a goal of zero waste. So.
I think one of my favorite creative solutions for that is we had a company that was trying to go zero waste, and their organics recycling program was one of the employees had a pig. And so they actually collected it, and then they slopped the hogs every night.
Awesome. And
it was awesome.
And you have a pig roast when the weather
absolutely
gets cool again.
I guess if you're not connected to your pet.
So this is great. And I hope some of our listeners are working at businesses, even if you're not the owner of that business.
Absolutely.
Go sit down with the owner, and if you're not doing the kind of recycling that you think you can do, you know, and you live in Johnson County, Craig has offered up some advice. He might even help you if you lived across state line, track some things down.
I can help you get connected.
So he can connect you. In fact, there's a lot of networking in the waste industry. We all like to talk trash, right?
You betcha. I love to talk trash.
You know, thank you very much for coming down here, Craig. We appreciate it. It's not as beautiful as the Monarch story, but it's a story we live with every day in our own homes. And if you're doing recycling, if you're helping the Monarchs planting milkweed, you're helping the planet. Thank you for listening tonight. This is Elaine Giesel, and I'm going to sign off. We're going to turn it over to Aaron, who's going to be talking about some upcoming events.
Yes, and I always get my events from greenabilitymagazine.com, so be sure to check out their website. And today I'd like to talk about Discovered Nature, and they'll be discussing prairies at this event that takes place on the first day of summer, June 21st, from 10 in the morning till 2:30 in the afternoon. Before settlement, the Kansas City area was part of a vast ecoregion known as the Tallgrass Prairie. Rediscover the prairie pest at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center with a day of activities that include wildflower walks, nature films, prairie plantings, and kids' crafts. This free event will be held from 10 to 2:30 on June 21st at the Discovery Center on 4750 Troost. And that's all I have for events.